Okay, we've been in Revelation 13 for 5 weeks now. This is number 6. And you'd think that we would be getting to the end of it, but we're not. Well, yeah, verse 1 and 2. Actually, we did get around it. We're talking also down to verse 6. But this is only the first half of Revelation 13. I mean, the message of Revelation 13. Because the second part of Revelation 13 deals with what this power that we're studying about now attempts to accomplish. What we're studying about now is what it did accomplish, and then it receives a deadly wound, and then when that deadly wound is restored or healed, then it will accomplish something else or attempt to. So what we're studying now is laying the foundation for what the second half is going to be all about. So we have to see what our history is now in order to know what's soon to come. And I've got something to hand out here this morning that's just a short little transcript. I mean, it's just part of the transcript that A.T. Jones gave before the Senate Subcommittee on Education and Labor, or Labor Education, whichever direction that went, in December 1888. And if you have not ever read that book, which, I mean, it's not a book, it's a book compiled of his transcript, it's the testimony that he gave, word for word, verbatim, before Senator Blair's bill. And Senator Blair was there representing his bill. So if you haven't read that, you need to get a copy of it. I have ordered some for here. And if they ever come, we will loan them out. I only got 4 copies because I figured we could share. I mean, it's a quick read. You know, you can read it and then pass it on to somebody else. If you want a copy, we can arrange for that too. It is available. But what he was dealing with in 1888 was the passage of a national Sunday law. We will soon face the passage of a national Sunday law. It didn't happen in 1888. It will happen. The same forces that were trying to get it approved in 1888 are still at work. It's the grandchildren of the groups that was working at that time. They're still in operation. They have different names. They've changed their name, but it's the grandchildren. So what we're looking at here in this lesson and the next lesson, and then 3 lessons down will be, so that's December. December's lesson will be a bonus lesson. And you're all going to say, what has that got to do with it? Well, it has a lot to do with it because it'll tie everything together. But the foundation that I've been laying with Gnosticism and the change of the Sabbath and this lesson and the next lesson will show you definitively what this power is that we're dealing with. So there's a little bit of review this morning, and then next time will be, you know, it'll zip right through because it's just, you know, this and this and this and this. You know, I'll show paganism, and then I'll show how it came into the church and back and forth, back and forth. This originally was one lesson. It made 3. That's why we never get through with this thing. There's too much information. We studied last time about the Gnostic influence, and this quote here is one that I don't think I shared last time. There was a 2-pronged attack against the Seventh-day Sabbath. One of it came from Gnosticism, and the other, as we looked at last week, was the political side of it, where because the Jews were causing so much trouble and rebelling against Rome, that if you were a Sabbath keeper, you were tied into these Jews who were rebellious, and you got labeled as such, even though you weren't part of the rebellion, and it worked to destroy Sabbath keeping. The so-called fathers studied the works of pagan philosophers far more than they did those of the apostles. They affected to be philosophers themselves, and while they did indeed make a show of combating paganism, now these Gnostic fathers are from the Alexandrian school, like we talked about, and it's such people as Marcion, Ignatius, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Origen, Cyprian. When you read any of the quotes and stuff that people might use, these men, they're Gnostics. Just understand that. And these men were famous writers just because they were willing to write. You know, the Christians were busy evangelizing. They didn't have time to sit down and write. These guys had time to write. So they wrote these letters, and they wrote these treatises, and they wrote these defenses, and those are the things that we now have collected up, and they're kept as the writings of the church fathers. They weren't the real people that, I mean, they weren't the men that were doing the work spreading the gospel. They were just men who were willing to write and thought they had something to say. So we've collected all their materials, and it's the traditions of the early church. Anyway, Wagner goes on, and he says, they affected to be philosophers themselves, and while they did indeed make a show of combating paganism, the weapons they used were more drawn from pagan philosophy and more frequently than from those from the Bible. So they got to where they weren't using the scriptures, because the scriptures, of course, didn't go along with what they were trying to do. So they could abandon the scriptures, write their own documents that they said was in defense of the scriptures, and then their writings became tradition that was handed down generation to generation. Even when they quoted from the Bible, their pagan notions warped their interpretation. Well, we see that today, don't we? You read scripture and you put your own little spin to it and say, well, that's what that means, when it isn't what it means at all. And that's why we say context, context, context. Don't take a verse out of context. What does the rest of the surrounding it say? What does the chapter say? What does the whole Bible have to say? You know, don't take a verse out of context. So these notions warp their interpretation. In pagan encounters with paganism, we have, for the most part, nothing but one form of paganism arrayed against another form of paganism. And if you read the material carefully, you will find that this is the truth. We find this error soon passed off as the truth. You know, they, because their material was handed around, people said, oh, well, Tertullian wrote this, or oh, well, Irenaeus wrote this, and so it's got to be true, you know, because he's a church father. And they read his material, they absorbed and accepted what he wrote, these little twists, and they did not pay attention to what poison it had in it. So this destructive work was going on before the death of Paul and John, because they both wrote about it. Their letters contain counsel regarding the negative influence of Gnosticism that was undermining the gospel. In a minute, we're going to look at more of what Paul has to say. But this two-pronged attack was a Gnostic influence that associated the Sabbath with darkness and evil creation, remember? So they saw that the true God created light on the first day. Then he kind of stepped back, and this is the Gnostic notion. And then these little lesser gods, of whom Christ is one. Christ was one of these little lesser gods, and he created everything, and these other little gods created everything that had to do with material matter. So the animals and the plants and, you know, that kind of stuff, that was all created by these lesser gods. And then the Seventh-day Sabbath came along, and that was celebrated as a memorial to the creation of matter. Well, the Gnostics see matter as evil. So the Seventh-day Sabbath was associated with the celebration of the creation of evil. First day comes around again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. One day again. Week starts again. That's the celebration of light. So for the Gnostics, Sunday has always been a celebration of light. Celebration of the sun came into it. That was the one prong. If you kept the Seventh-day Sabbath, you were celebrating evil. They wanted to celebrate light and what they thought was the biggie god. So they celebrated on Sunday. This Gnostic influence went from Alexandria to Rome and was readily accepted by the Christians at Rome. Then you had the political pressure on the other side. The political pressure came from the wars, remember, and went on for a couple of hundred years, with these rebellions that took place in Palestine. The Sabbath keepers true Sabbath keepers became associated with political revolution and social instability. So that even though you were a law-abiding Christian and you didn't do anything to cause trouble against the civil government, because you were a Sabbath keeper, you were labeled with those Jews who were causing civil unrest. So there was no distinction made. Well, these two things worked like pincers to destroy Sabbath truth over a period of a couple of hundred years. So that by the time we get to Constantine, and, well, it began earlier than that. The scripture talks, I mean, it went on for more than 100 years, this terrible persecution, where if you were a Christian or a Jew, if you were a Sabbath keeper, you lost your home, you lost your goods, you lost everything. You were crucified, you were thrown to the lions, anything they could do to you, they did. So, under Emperor Diocletian, who ruled from 284 to 305, persecution of Christians who were Sabbath keepers was increased. And we looked at this last week. Beginning on February 23rd in AD 303, that was the festal day of the god Terminus. Remember when we discussed the god Terminus, who was this guy that they celebrated because he was the one that put boundaries? You know, so they figured if they set this persecution of Christians on the day of Terminus festival, then they were setting a boundary on Christianity. Remember? This lasted for 10 years. It was foretold by Christ in the message to the second church in Revelations 2, 8, and 11. Diocletian brought in more bureaucracy and military growth, constant war on the frontiers. By this time, Rome had reached its farthest extent, and it began to be very, almost impossible to deal with the border. They couldn't keep people from trying to invade them and take over. So he was in constant war on the borders. He had constant construction projects that increased the state's expenditures, necessitating a comprehensive tax reform. You think Rome didn't have taxes? Oh, yeah, they did. Diocletian standardized imperial taxation in an attempt to make it more equitable, and he levied taxes at generally higher rates. In 301, he attempted to curb inflation via price controls. Things haven't changed. You know, what we see going on in politics right now at the federal and state level, it was happening, you know, 1,000 years ago, so, or 2,000 years ago. So, you know, it's, thing doesn't change. But while all this was being undertaken, he also sought to stamp out this new religion that was considered a serious threat to the stability of the government and society in general. Why was it considered a serious threat? Because they were associated with the Sabbath-keeping Jews who were causing the instability. Christians who adhered to the Seventh-day Sabbath were the main target of Diocletian's religious reformation. They were easy to identify because they refused to participate in the things that the pagans did. So they were peculiar. Remember, we looked last time at quirky Christians, remember? Okay, so they were easy to identify because they didn't do the pagan practices, such as, you know, those things that honored and commemorated the pagan gods and goddesses, such as lighting candles in their windows. If you didn't have a candle in your window, then you stood out. If you didn't have a wreath hanging on your door, you were noticed. If you didn't offer little incense when you went into certain areas, it was noticed that you didn't throw the incense on the fire. So because you were a Christian and you didn't participate in these pagan things, you were noticed. Now, there were Christians who said, what difference does it make if I have a little candle in the window? It'll just make light for my room. What difference does it make if I have a wreath on the front door? What's a wreath? It's no big deal. What difference does it make if I just pitch a little incense in the pot there as I go by? You know, all these little compromises just to keep them out of trouble. But it was a false witness, wasn't it? They were watched by their neighbors. And if they didn't do these things, they were hauled into court and tried. So Jesus counseled to this church. And under the angel of the church of Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, because they had faith in God. And Rome was unable to stamp that faith out. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not. Now, to say you're a Jew, we talked about that. You know, this is a figurative sense, you know, because Paul talks about Jews who are spiritual Jews, not a Jew genetically. And you can read about this discussion in Romans 2:28 and 29. Chapter 9, verse 6 and 7, Galatians 3, 28 and 29, you know, Paul makes a comparison of spiritual people and he calls them Jews. Christ here is addressing the problem that we've been studying about of people who claim to be Christians and followers of Christ, but they had not completely forsaken their paganism. It was during this church period that the early church fathers were bringing in these Gnostic notions. We had a big influx of pagans into the church. These Gnostic notions appealed to them. So it caught on like wildfire. The third church period that follows, you have the Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, as we go through the seven churches there in Revelation chapter 2 and 3. The Pergamos church is called so because in that church period, paganism became firmly married to, gamos is Mary. So Pergamos church, paganism became firmly married to Christianity. Okay, Christ goes on and he says, I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. That's a pretty strong statement. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you in prison, which happened, that ye may be tried. And ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Christ plainly states here that all that was going on was the work of Satan. This tribulation 10 days, you know, this is a prophecy, so we've got to read that as prophetic time. 10 days is 10 years, day for a year, right? So the persecution came to an end. This Diocletian the persecution of Diocletian began, came to an end in 313. A significant fact from this period is that in order to save themselves, Christian leaders of these congregations handed over the copies of their writings of the apostles. It was known that they had a Bible. We're going to call it a Bible. It wasn't a Bible at that point, but it was the writings of the apostles. It was known that they had these writings. If you were unwilling to hand over your Bible, they said, well, you're one of these people. They'd persecute you. So it became difficult to maintain Bibles, scriptures. They were kept in secret, hidden, bits and pieces here and there. Because the Roman authorities burned these scriptures. When they would get them, they'd burn them. So I'm sure that you've seen commentary when you go and you buy a new translation of the Bible. And they say, this Bible is based on the most ancient manuscripts. You've seen that advertisement, right? That's not necessarily a good thing. Because those most ancient manuscripts are the ones that nobody used. That's why they didn't get burned. That's why they didn't get recopied. So they're the ones that are not necessarily the most accurate. The ones that were the most accurate were the ones that were destroyed, either from use and recopied or burned, like here. So these leaders who were turning over the manuscripts, turning over their Bibles, when the congregations found out what they did, they were not allowed to continue work in that congregation. They were cast out because they saw them as traitors, not only to that church, but traitors to God. There's a lesson there for us too. Your Bible's precious. This is a map that shows how the kingdom, or the empire, had gotten so large, extended all the way up into Britain, that it had to be divided into four pieces. I don't know if you can see these colors real well, but it was divided into four pieces. You had this, and this, and this, and this. It was four pieces there. And even though Diocletian was the big guy, that's why he's called Augustus, Caesar Augustus, he had generals out there that had equal power, and they could work and do what they needed to do in order to control that section of the empire, because he couldn't be everywhere all at one time. And it took so long. They didn't have internet back then. You know, they didn't have text messaging. It took time to get messages back and forth. So he had to have generals that he could just turn loose and say, okay, you take care of that frontier. Well, as you can imagine, a couple of those generals decided that they wanted to be chief. They didn't like being second in command. One of them was Constantine. You see him up there. Constantine the Great had Britain and the what is now France, Gaul. he said, I'm going to take over. And he had a friend over on the other side over there that said, I'm going to take over. They both tried to take over. In 293, the Emperor Diocletian split this empire into four sections. The division was created by Diocletian because the empire had become so huge that any single ruler was only capable of personally commanding troops on one front at the time. He just couldn't deal with it. Constantius was Constantine the First, or the Great's, father. There was a sling. Constantine named his sons Constantine. He had three of them that were Constantius, Constantine, whatever. They were all the same kind of name. It was like, we have Joyce and Joycey and Joyces, Constantine was elected by his army to be a leader. And that's how these leaders came about. They said, we like this guy. He follows pretty well. He's honest. He's whatever. And the army is what elected him. Constantine decides that he wanted to be Caesar Augustus, not just a Caesar, but Caesar Augustus. And he invaded the northern territory of Maximilian. You see what Maximinius? Okay, so Maximian had Italy. And this is just a little bit of history to lead into what's going on here. Constantine invaded the northern area. You can see the Milan up there and the little Ravenna River. That's the area where he was coming in. And he crossed the Tiber River, which was down by Rome. You see Rome there. And on the evening of October 27th, 312 AD, he had the armies preparing for battle on the other side of the Tiber River, on the north side of the Tiber River. Constantine had this vision. And up in the sky, he thought he saw these lights. This last week, there was two separate sightings of what they thought was UFOs. Did you see that? The one in New York was not ever said what it was, but the one out in Arizona, wherever it was out there, that was sky jumpers that had flares on their feet. But the one in New York was never identified, and that was during the day. So I don't believe in UFOs, but I just thought that was interesting that two things happened at one time. Anyway, here's Constantine, and he sees these lights up in the sky. And he was preparing for battle, he took this to be a sign, because being pagan, they look for all kinds of signs, omens in the skies and whatnot. So he saw this, and superimposed over where this light was, you see up there? Of course, this is a painting. This is a painting. Yeah. Right there. He thought he saw the two Greek letters, R, capital R. It looks like a P, but it's an R if you're Greek. And an X. It doesn't show up real well there. So you see there's a P and then there's an X superimposed over the bottom of it down there. The R and the X. Well, he saw this and he assumed that it was the first two letters representing Christos, Cairo, the first two letters of the name of Christ and the symbol for the Christian church. Now he just dreamed this up. Now this symbol was not used by the church. But he thought, oh, okay, look here, we have the R and the X and, there's Cairo and it's got to be a sign here for me. Now, did this really happen? Yes, it did. Astronomers have determined that a syzygy or conjunction of a close alignment of three planets, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter, did take place on this date. Isn't that amazing how they can go back and figure that out? Okay, well, they did. So they said, yes, there really was a thing that he was able to see, but the Cairo probably wasn't there. So from this, he said, okay, I see this as a sign, an omen, that I'm going to win the battle. So if you go into a battle knowing you're going to win, you're more likely to win, right? So he did. He won the battle. But I want you to understand that he was not a Christian. He was a pagan. And he looked for this for pagan omens. He looked at it from a pagan perspective. So, you know, don't think that because he saw this and he associated it with Christ and the Christian church and whatnot, that he was a Christian. He was not. He was a pagan. And at this time, remember, persecution of Christians was still going on. So, he did defeat Maxentius on the next day, crossed the Tiber River, and entered into Rome. Oh, by the way, the bridge is still there. Rome built things. They stayed. And 6 months later, he and Licinius got together and they passed the Edict of Milan that gave toleration to the Christian religion. Now, we talked last time about how this toleration from the Edict of Milan was not true freedom. Do you like to be tolerated? Everybody likes to be tolerated, right? You know, your little quirkies and your little personality dysfunctions and whatnot, you know, you just want people to tolerate them. I know I do. You know, so the toleration when we're talking about religion is not good. They can take toleration away from you in a heartbeat. True freedom, as we have written in our First Amendment, that's law. That's there. It's ours until they rewrite the Constitution. But if they write a law giving toleration to you so that you can worship like you want to, all they have to do is say, hey, we don't, you know, you're misbehaving or whatever, and they can take that toleration away. And that's one of the complaints that A.T. Jones had with this Sunday law that was trying to get passed in 1888, because they were going to make an exemption for anybody that kept the Seventh-day Sabbath, Seventh-day Baptist, Seventh-day Adventist, Jews, whatever, you know. They were going to make an exemption in this law. So that because you were a Seventh-day Adventist or you were a Jew or you were a Seventh-day Baptist or whatever else out there that kept the Sabbath, they weren't going to make you work on the Sabbath and be off on Sunday. They weren't going to do that. They were going to give you toleration here. And Jones stood up before the Senate and he said, I don't want to be tolerated, because he knew what that meant. He said, the First Amendment law gives me freedom, and you will not persecute me for resting on the Sabbath and working on Sunday. Was Constantine truly converted? 13 years after he became emperor, this column was constructed, and this over here, on this side over here, is what remains of it. It's still there. This picture was taken like in 2001, something. This is on this side is what it originally was depicted to be like, and there was a statue at the top of it that was supposed to be Constantine. Now, when this was built, it was 164 feet tall. It's like a huge obelisk, which of course is pagan. At the top of it was the statue that represented Constantine, and it was patterned after the pagan god Apollo. Apollo was supposed to be the god of light and the sun. So that was depicting Constantine as this Gnostic god of light, right? Apollo was also the god of truth and prophecy and medicine and healing. All kinds of things were attributed to Apollo. And they were saying that Constantine was this Apollo. So 17 years after Constantine claimed conversion, because he saw this light in the sky and he thought he saw the Cairo up there emblazoned over it, if he allowed this to happen, was he a true Christian? Couldn't have been. Constantine did consider himself to be the head of the Christian church, and he was the one that thought that he should solve the church's problems. You know, if you got a dispute, you went to Constantine to solve the problem. Now, if we had a dispute in this country, would we go to the president of the United States? No. Not, you know, I mean, he should have nothing to do with what I do in my church. But because they didn't have separation of church and state, because remember, under Rome, the state was in charge and the church was legal under state law, so there was no such thing as separation of church and state. That meant that the emperor could decide what happened in your church. Now, Constantine was a fairly mild-mannered guy, and he didn't like all this persecution that was going on and the murdering, literally murdering of his people in his empire. So he passed the first Sunday law. It was enacted in AD 321. This law gave toleration to Christians. But by this time, there had been so much controversy about the seventh-day Sabbath that there were very few people that were keeping the seventh-day Sabbath. So when he passed the Sunday law, it was putting in place the day that most of the Christians had come to keep. The Emperor Constantine, after his conversion to Christianity, made the observance of Sunday a civil duty. That's the key point. And the law which commanded it is found in the Roman Code. Now, this is what I've been talking about. I want you to understand what's being said here. And who said it? The United States Catholic Magazine in 1845. What's being said here is that Sunday, under Constantine, was legislated as a civil obligation, not a religious one. The law was written into the civil code of the government of Rome. In 1888, the groups such as the Women's Christian Temperance Organization, Baptist preachers, some politicians, were attempting to pass Sunday laws, make them federal laws so that they were throughout the land. The law that I've told you about, that Jones witnessed against in 1888 before the Senate, they were attempting to pass a civil law that made you rest on the first day of the week. They were calling it a civil law, not a religious law, even though they were trying to reform the morals of this nation, which is the same thing that the One Nation Under God people are trying to do. Same idea. I mean, it hadn't changed, and we just need to understand our history, and we'll understand what's going on in the world right now. So, but it was a civil enactment that happened in Rome, and it's a civil enactment that they're trying to get passed right now. By his civil legislation, he made Sunday a rest day, he being Constantine. His famous Sunday law of March 7, 321 reads, "On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and the people residing in the cities rest, and let all workshops be closed." But those in agricultural things could keep on doing what they needed to do. If your hay needed to be harvested on Sunday, that was okay. You were exempt. This was the first in a series of steps taken by Constantine and by later Christian emperors in regulating Sunday observance. It is obvious that this first Sunday law was not particularly Christian in orientation. And why not? Well, because he says he was designating it to the venerable day of the sun. That right there is paganism. Also, it is evident that Constantine did not base his Sunday laws on the regulations of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, because he exempted agricultural work, a type of work that is strictly forbidden in the fourth commandment that's found in Exodus 20, verse 8 to 11. So this first Sunday law was not a Christian law. It was a civil law. From Rome, there came now another addition to the Sunday worship apostasy. As a result of the Sunday law being established, then these apostates who were working to reform the church and make it more acceptable to society, they were calling themselves Christians, but they were working to make the church acceptable to society. From Rome, there came now another addition to the Sunday worship apostasy. The first Christians, being mostly Jews, continued to celebrate the Passover in remembrance of the death of Christ, the true Passover. Accordingly, the celebration was always on the Passover day, the 14th of the first month, Nisan. Remember, we looked at this, and we looked at how the calendar, if you're going to keep the 14th day of Nisan, it's just like keeping my birthday, you know. It moves through the days of the week. Sometimes it's on a Monday, sometimes it's on a Friday, right? Well, that's the way you're going to keep it if you're going to keep the day that Christ was resurrected. Okay? Just because the year that Christ died and the time that Christ died, he actually came out of the grave on a Sunday, doesn't mean that we need necessarily to always remember his resurrection on a Sunday. If you're going to remember it always as it happened, you'll do it on the 16th of Nisan, which moves through the year. right? I mean, through the week. Okay, the Gnostics didn't like this notion because they wanted to tie it into this eighth day thing. Remember? Eighth day, first day, same day. Okay, so Rome, however, and from her all of the West, adopted the day of the sun as the day of this celebration. The rule of Rome was that the celebration must always be on a Sunday. And they calculated it as the Sunday nearest to the 14th of the first month of the Jewish year. So, because Jews were hated, because they were Sabbath keepers, all these changes came. It's a complex thing. You can't just say the church changed Sabbath to Sunday. It didn't happen that way. It's complex. It went over hundreds of years before it was finally nailed down. Jews, you may know this already, Jews calculate the Passover, and they still, of course, keep the Passover. They calculate the Passover as the new moon, which is no moon. It's the dark of the moon. The first new moon after the spring equinox. The spring equinox, they can calculate. They know when the stars and the sun gets wherever, and it's the spring equinox. They know that. And they say, okay, that's the day. That's the spring equinox. Then they count. That's the first of their month. Then 14 days later is Passover. Christians said, we can't calculate it that way because it ties us into those Jews that we don't like. So we're going to adjust it a little bit, and we're going to calculate it according to the full moon. So Easter is calculated according to the first full moon that occurs after the spring equinox. And that puts it off a little bit. It puts it off like 2 weeks. Now sometimes Passover and Easter get real close together because of the way things happen. That's how we got Easter. We know not precisely when this began, but it was practiced in Rome as early as the time of Sixtus I, who was bishop of Rome, 119 to 128. So this argument came around fairly early. Victor, who was bishop at Rome from 192 to 202, proposed to command everyone everywhere to conform to these practices of Rome. Rome had decided that they're going to keep Easter. They're going to keep the celebration of the resurrection on Sunday. That's what they did, and they wanted everybody else everywhere else to do the same thing. Because the Eastern prelates refused to follow him, he pronounced them unworthy of the name of brethren and excluded them from all fellowship with the Church of Rome. He got up on his high horse, stuck his thumbs in his armpits, and said, I'm the big cheese. You're going to do it the way I tell you to do it. Or I don't like you and you can't be a part of my church. This is papal pride. And this is the foundation of that papal pride that goes on and becomes the papacy. Where one man says, I can control what everybody else does. And I'm big enough. I've got enough power behind me. I've got enough people standing next to me. I've got an army behind me or whatever else. And you're going to do what I tell you to do. It would take another 100 years before this papal pride actually came into any kind of power. And do we remember the year? We've studied this how many times? Do we remember the year when it became law that the bishop at Rome was the one that was in charge of everything, including the government of the Western Empire? Do we remember the year? Mouths drop open, head fingers to foreheads. I don't know. 538, thank you very much. And he hasn't even been here for the last year and a half. Because of all the conflict that was going on in the churches, they had to call several councils, ecumenical councils, to try to hammer out things. And Easter was the big thing that happened. That was the Council of Nicaea. They also repudiated Arianism. Do we know who Arius was? We talked about him a long time ago. And we talked about the conflict that he bought. And we talked about, in our earlier studies, how it was the Arians, the Arian tribes, that were the ones that were destroyed. Remember, there was 10 horns, and then 3 were destroyed. The 3 that were destroyed, you know, they call them barbarians. They weren't barbarians. They were Christians who kept the notions of Arius. They didn't fall under what Rome wanted them to believe religiously. They were destroyed. The Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, right? They were Arians. So we have this legacy of paganism that's beginning to develop. And Christians became thought of as dangerous people. Though the Romans gave an unlimited toleration to all religions which had nothing in their tenets dangerous to the commonwealth. And remember we said that when Rome would go and conquer somebody, you know, they would accept their paganism, whatever it was. They would take their gods back to Rome and they would build statues along this road. And at one time there were 1,000 statues along this road. Every god in the empire was allowed by Rome. Except, well, I mean, for a time, the god of the Christians was allowed because Christians didn't cause any trouble. But when the Christians became associated because of their Sabbath keeping with the Jews who were causing trouble, then all of a sudden Rome didn't like this god anymore. And they were dangerous to the commonwealth. Yet Rome would not permit that of the religion of their ancestors, which was established by the laws of the state. We looked at this last time too, remember? Union of church and state. Rome established the laws of the civil government. They also established religion. So they didn't allow anything that was contrary to the laws of the state to be turned into derision, nor the people to be drawn away from their attachment to it. So if you came along as a Christian and you said, well, you know, this god that you're worshiping over here, this Apollos and this, you know, Ishtar, whatever, they're not true gods. The God of the heaven is the true gods. You know, Jesus Christ, his son, is the true God. Well, then you were causing trouble because you were trying to convert people away from these pagan gods. These, however, were the two things which those Christians were charged with. They dared to ridicule the absurdities of the pagan superstition, and they were ardent and assiduous in gaining proselytes to the truth. I mean, that's what Christians are supposed to do, right? You go out and you're supposed to convert the world. Nor did they only attack the religion of Rome, but also the different shapes and forms under which superstition appeared in the various countries where they exercised their ministry. From hence, the Romans concluded that the Christian sect was not only unsupportably daring and arrogant, but moreover an enemy to the public tranquility, working in every way to excite civil wars and commotions in the empire. So because you were a Christian and you tried to get your neighbor to believe like you did, you were an enemy to public tranquility. These excite civil wars was tied into those Jewish wars. They didn't have anything to do with the work of the Christians. But because of the Sabbath connection, okay, I've said that over and over, we're beginning to catch on, right? Another circumstance that irritated the Romans against Christians was the simplicity of their worship, which resembled nothing in the sacred rites of other people. They didn't have the burning of incense. They didn't have the lighting of candles. They didn't have the hanging of wreaths on their front door. They didn't do those things. They worshiped God in a simple manner, as Jesus had taught them to. The Christians had neither sacrifices, nor temples, nor images, nor oracles, nor sacerdotal orders. They didn't have priests. And this was sufficient to bring upon them the reproaches of an ignorant multitude, that ignorant multitude that didn't understand them, who imagined that there could not be a religion without these. How do you have a religion? How do you have any kind of thing that worships God if you don't do these things? If you don't have a priest, if you don't have sacrifices, if, you know, how do you have a religion? Well, they looked upon Christians as some sort of atheist because there was no outward sign by which they could connect them to religion. And by the Roman laws, those who were chargeable with atheism were declared the pests of human society. Now, under Rome, you could believe anything you wanted to. You could worship any number of gods that you wanted to worship. Didn't matter how outlandish they were. But if you didn't worship some kind of god that they could point to, then you were an atheist. So Christians who didn't have an idol in their house, who didn't go to these temples and do all these things, they had no outward show, nothing that they could say that they tied into their religion. They didn't at that time wear crosses around their necks. You know, the cross was a sign of derision. You know, they didn't want to remember Christ in that way. So they had nothing like this. And it brought them under suspicion as being atheists. And as you were, if you were an atheist, then you could be hauled into court, tried, crucified. How about that? Now think for a moment about the current move in this country, I mentioned it earlier, to bring this nation back under God. It's widespread, especially in this neck of the woods. You see all the little signs out in people's yards. One nation under God and the Ten Commandments, and you know, you see that. Well, the cry of the religious lot, right, is one nation under God. And they think that if they can bring people back to keeping the Ten Commandments, with a modified fourth commandment, of course, that they'll get this country back under the blessings of God. Isn't that what they say? Well, these people mean well. Their desire is to see things go away, bad things. You know, they're fighting against abortion, they're fighting against pornography, they're fighting against all these things that need to be removed from society, right? So they've got a right idea. They're going about it in the wrong way. You change society by converting a human being one human at the time. That's how you change society. You don't change society by legislating laws. You cannot legislate morality. And they'll say, well, why can't we legislate morality? We have a law that says you can't murder, and we have a law that says you can't steal, and we have a law against perjury, so why can't you legislate morals? A.T. Jones was very clear in his argument here before the Senate. You can't legislate morals, because what you're doing when you say you cannot murder your brother, that's a civil action. It is uncivil behavior to kill your next-door neighbor. It is uncivil behavior to go and steal your neighbor's boat. So they can pass laws that control civility among human beings. They can pass laws like that. But they can't pass a moral law, because morals have to do with what's in your mind and your heart, and the state doesn't know what's in your mind and your heart. And it can't control what's in your mind and your heart. And Jones brought this out very clearly in his testimony before the Senate. He said, you have no law against a man who lives next door to a neighbor and hates him the whole time he lives next door to this man, hates him with a passion. Even though he doesn't go kill that neighbor, according to Scripture, he has committed murder. Because if you hate your brother, you've murdered him. So Jones says, you really can't pass a law that controls morals. Because the man who hates his brother is being immoral. But you can pass a law that prevents that man from carrying out his hatred and killing his neighbor. There's a distinction. And that's what we need to understand. And that's what people who are pushing this one nation under God don't understand. They think that they can pass laws and make people behave in moral ways. No, they can't. So the day will come when they do pass a Sunday law. And those of us who will not abide by that Sunday law will be called heretics. And the same persecution will come against us. Because your First Amendment rights will have been dissolved. The Christians were pronounced atheists because they were destitute of temples and altars and victims and priests and all the pomp. To silence this accusation, the Christian doctors of Alexandria and Rome, who brought their Gnosticism in, thought that it was necessary to introduce some external rites which would strike the senses of the people so that they could maintain that they did possess all those things of which Christians were charged with being destitute. So if they had their preacher put on some pretty little robes and wear a little hood on his head and whatever, you know, then they said, well, he's my priest, then that would model after what the pagans did, and they could say, okay, well, see, now we have, you know, we're like you. You know, our pastor dresses like your pagan gods. And if we light candles in the church, you know, and we say certain prayers repetitiously in the church, and we do all these things, well, then, you know, they have all these external rites, and we're going to look like the pagans around us, and we won't be so out of step. But we'll still call ourselves Christians. What was it Isaiah, what is it, 4 says? You know, they want to be called by thy name, but we'll do our own thing. Right? All these quotes are these long quotes, and I quoted them extensively just because they were so important. This is the book. It's available online as a out of Google Books if you want to go read it. I never found a copy of it, but Google Books is good. Part of the Gutenberg Project, and they put all these old books on there, and you can go and sit there by the hour, by the week, and read these things. And Mosheim is one of the most, he used to be, And the old books that I still have, Moysheim is one of the ones that they quote extensively because his history was so accurate. Such was the tendency of the times during the 4th century to adulterate Christianity with the spirit of paganism, partly to conciliate the prejudices of the worldly converts. We were making Christians out of pagans. We didn't want them to be unhappy, so we allowed them to bring some of their pagan things into the church with them. And partly to conciliate the prejudices of the worldly converts, and partly in the hope of securing its more rapid spread, Christianity's more rapid spread. There is a solemnity in a truthful accusation which Faustus makes to Augustine. You have substituted your agape feast for the sacrifices of the pagans. So this guy Faustus could see that what they were doing, that they were calling communion service, they had turned it into something that really wasn't the basic communion service. They made a feast day out of it, made a feast thing out of it, where you came together and you had a meal, and then you celebrated the emblems, you did that. But we had this dinner that we did, we got together on Friday night and we had fruit and juice and beverages and we had a good time. That's the same thing that they did when they sacrificed to pagans. So Faustus recognized this, and he said, no, you have substituted your agape feast for the sacrifices of the pagans. Your idols that stood in the church. We had an idol here that was to Apollo, and we had an idol over there that was to Ishtar, and we had an idol over there that when the Christians took over these churches, when they converted all the people in these churches, they just said, well, that idol over there, well, it isn't really Apollo anymore. We'll call it Peter. And this one over here that was to Ishtar, well, Ishtar is a female goddess, and so, well, we'll just call that Mary. So they didn't do away with these idols. They just renamed them. And that's what's being spoken of here. Your idols turn into your martyrs. You just rename them. Nothing distinguishes you from the pagans except that you hold your assemblies apart from them. You don't meet under the same roof, but everything else that you're doing is the same thing that they do. I told you earlier that Paul discussed this, and I'm going to read right straight through this prophecy. We've discussed this prophecy before. I'm going to go into details. Now that we've got all this foundation here of the history that we've come across, we're going to see how it was fulfilled. Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 to 8, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. Then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Let's look at this pieces at the time. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. That's what we've been studying the last few lessons that we've done here, is that falling away from the pure truth, that acceptance of paganism in its various forms, not just the Sunday worship, but all the other little rites and things that they brought in. That's all baptizing paganism and bringing it into the church. This power exalts himself. And what did we say about that Victor, Bishop of Rome, who said, if you don't do the things I want, and if you don't keep the resurrection on the first day of the week like I tell you to, then you're not going to have any part of me. I excommunicate you. Exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, showing himself that he is God. Eventually, this bishop of Rome, over successions of a couple of hundred years, put himself as God on earth. He had the ability, he said, to determine what was right and what was wrong within the church. Remember ye not that when I was still with you, I told you these things, and now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity does already work. When Paul wrote this to the Thessalonians, and this was his second letter to the Thessalonians, that mystery of iniquity was already at work. Gnosticism was already beginning to come in to the church, and he knew it. Only he who now letteth will let. Now this is where most people stumble. This sounds like he who now is allowing will allow, right? I mean, that's the way you read it. He who lets will let. You know, if I let my child go out and play, I'm allowing him to go out and play, right? Well, no. This is an old English term. This is the King James Version of the Bible. Let means hinder. means exact opposite. So if you're standing in the way and you're hindering, you're going to have to be taken out of the way in order to allow something to go on, right? So we need to read this. This is Young's literal translation, puts it in a little easier. For the secret of lawlessness, that mystery of iniquity, does already work, only he who is keeping down will hinder till he be taken out of the way. Here's another one. New Revised Standard. Until the one who now restrains is removed. So there was something that was standing in the way that prevented this apostasy from fully taking over. What was standing in the way? Pagan Rome. Papal Rome could not come to full power until pagan Rome subsided. And that's exactly what we see happen. When Justinian gave the law, Justinian was emperor, when he gave the law, he said that the emperor, the bishop of Rome, was corrector of heretics, of everybody in the church, and he had control of the church, and he had control of the civil government in Italy, the whole Western Empire. When he did that, pagan Rome was removed, and papal Rome then was unrestrained. And this prophecy was fulfilled. Then papal Rome grew into supreme power. And I stood on the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. This is Revelation 13. What does blasphemy mean? Blasphemy is to arrogate the attributes belonging to God alone. This commentary, standard commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, says that this is a characteristic of the little horn. Well, isn't that interesting? Where is the little horn talked about? In Daniel chapter 7, the little horn is mentioned as being that little horn that comes up among the 10 horns. And when that little horn comes up, 3 horns go down, right? The 3 horns that went down were the Herali, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals, because they were Arian. And the bishop at Rome wouldn't tolerate Arian's notions. Okay. What did the Arians do? They believed different on the nature of Christ, and they believed different on the method of salvation. No, but they, because, and the Arians, you know, the notions of Arius are still with us today. There are churches, I won't name them, but there are churches that still believe these things. The characteristic of the little horn was blasphemy. This commentary ties it into Daniel because of the little horn, but it ties it into 2 Thessalonians 2:4. The little horn is the power that's being talked about in 2 Thessalonians 2:4. There was given unto him this power, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Now in prophecy, what's 42 months? 1260 days. This 1260 days started in 538. How long did they last? To 1798. What happened in 1798? This is all, we've already studied this when we did chapter 11. What happened in 1798? The Pope was taken captive by Berthier, working under the command of Napoleon, who was working under the command of the French Revolution. Napoleon wasn't emperor at that point. The French Revolution was still going on. And it did strike a blow to the head, the leader of the church. This leader of the church, now we're not talking about an individual. Don't hang up on an individual. This prophecy is not about a man with a name. It's about an institution. Because it took place over 1260 years, it can't possibly be about a single individual. But whatever individual takes that position within the church has the same attitude. He holds the same beliefs. He has the same doctrines. He has the same agenda. So what's the summary of this? He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. The papacy does this. He, as God, sits in the temple of God or the place of God. The papacy claims to be God on earth. He shows or claims that he is God. So all these things are fulfilled in the papacy. We're not knocking the church. All we're doing is talking about historical evidence that points to the fulfillment of this prophecy. Next time, we'll look at how this compromise played itself out and how the paganism came into the church. We'll look specifically at some of the pagan notions that came in. And then the next time, in order to help Amanda, so this will be December, we will talk about the daily. We're finally going to get around to it, Amanda. Had to build some foundation. And everybody's going to say, the daily, what has the daily got to do with what we're studying here? It has everything to do with what we're studying here, because the daily is paganism exalted. And what we're talking about, what we've talked about here this morning and last week, was the exaltation of paganism as it was brought into the church.